It is Sunday, September 14th, 2025. My arm is warm. My back is rested. Once again, the most difficult job in college football podcasting has fallen to me. I'm Zach Barnett, your backup host of the Football Scoop podcast. Moving left to right on your screen is Doug Samuels, John Bryce. How are we, gentlemen?
Great. Great Sunday.
Yeah, we're good. Yesterday was a full plate of college football. Picks didn't go as well for me yesterday as they went Thursday and Friday night. But anyway, we carry on.
Let's start with the game of the night, the game of the day. It certainly lived up to the billing and then some. Texas A&M 41, Notre Dame 40. John, take us away.
Yeah, a game I was at, a game in which Notre Dame twice had double-digit leads, and a game that Notre Dame the Irish folks tell me that they look like they had a Brian Van Gorder defense, and that's not a good thing. That's, you never hear BVG in reverential tones around the Golden Dome, but Notre Dame taxed for almost 500 yards of offense. Marcel Reed only completed 17 of 37 passes, but tallied 360 yards. He averaged 21-plus yards per completion. Texas A&M absolutely found a way to win. Also 100% true is that Notre Dame found a way to lose. They're now 0-2. You deserve all the credit in the world, Zach. You called it last month. You said you would take Notre Dame on the under 10.5 wins, and you absolutely said, even if you didn't pick it this week, you absolutely said Notre Dame was more likely to go 0-2 than 2-0. They are 0-2. They don't have a presently ranked team left on their schedule right now, and there's nothing about this team that makes you think they can reel off 10 consecutive wins the way that it did a year ago to make the playoffs. They're not in a conference. They're teetering on their season truly being over, and it's not even the middle of September.
Doug, what did you think about the game?
I just caught the tail end. We had some U Sports stuff, but Texas A&M's ability to make plays and overcome adversity, that holding call on the kick return that went for a touchdown by the tight end, number 17, being able to overcome that and find a way to respond. I think Colin Klein has been a great hire at Texas A&M. He's done an admirable job with the offense. And you can see what happened to Kansas State after his departure. They've kind of tanked, especially this year. But their ability to make plays down the stretch, they knew that Notre Dame was going to double the slots in that key last scoring situation. So they ran the tight end on the wheel with two posts and got a one-on-one of the tight end who I believe played a bunch of time at Nebraska, like 4 or 5 years at Nebraska. Comes down and makes a big play, and you can rely on your veteran to do something like that. But that was a great play call, great execution, found the one-on-one and took advantage.
I mean, for me, this was about the A&M passing game. Whether they won the game or not, I just wanted to see how they executed in key moments, and boy, did they. Marcel Reed, you mentioned it, John. You don't often see this stat line. Under 50% completions – but throwing for 360 yards, more than 20 yards per completion. It's almost like a service academy in that regard. Marcel Reed is 17 to 37, 360, two touchdowns and a pick. The highlight play for me was the 86-yard touchdown to Mario Craver. A great play call, great execution, and poor execution by Notre Dame's defense. That never should have been a touchdown, but credit to him for making that happen. So Craver went 7 for 207 and a touchdown. Casey Concepcion, 4 for 82. That's why you paid those guys the money you paid them. Yeah. And that this win was – I'm not going to sit here and be Mr. Hyperbole Man, but it's one of the biggest wins in A&M program history, whether it's 10 or 5 or whatever. I'll let the maroon-blooded Aggies debate that one, but it's in there. Certainly the biggest win of the Mike Elko era, and it's not close. Their first ranked road non-conference win since they beat Penn State on the road in 1979. And they did so in a game where they had to fight, scratch, and claw. A little bit of poetic justice, I think, when the game opens with Notre Dame blocking a punt for a touchdown, and Notre Dame had dominated special teams for most of the game until they didn't, and Tyler Buckner drops the snap that provides the winning point for A&M. I wanted to see how Colin Klein called the game and how Reed executed in key moments, in key passing situations. And it doesn't get any more key than fourth in the game. And you throw to your blocking tight end who hadn't had a catch all game long on fourth and 11. And they schemed it up great. They loved that one-on-one matchup. Doug, you mentioned it. Reed saw it and ripped it. And Nate, let me get this right. Nate Berkshire, I didn't get it right. Anyway, had an 11-yard touchdown catch, his only catch of the game, and one of the biggest receptions in Texas A&M football history.
Yeah, he boxed out Drake Bowen. Just did a nice job there. And now – yeah, that A&M won the game. Notre Dame had ample opportunity to win that game. Again, two 10-point leads at home in the first half. You block a punt for a touchdown. You had a 6-plus minute edge in time of possession. And A&M had far more penalties, but Notre Dame had penalties at the absolute worst times, ripping a player's helmet off in the end zone. A defensive holding penalty there late on what proved to be the game-winning touchdown march for the Aggies. And so there's a lot of consternation in the Midwest about the Irish. They've now lost three in a row dating to the title game. It's the second time since Marcus Freeman took over the program that they have a three-game losing streak. Those are just facts.
JB, this is semantics, but as someone that was there and saw the whole game and has a great pulse on the Irish, did Texas A&M win the game or did Notre Dame lose the game?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to give both credit, because A&M showed remarkable resolve to give up that late score, and Notre Dame was pretty physically assertive in that go-ahead touchdown drive to take a 40-34 lead. You're on the road. I thought the atmosphere was even louder than the college football playoff game last December inside Notre Dame Stadium when Indiana visited. They'd given away those yellow terrible towels, their version of the terrible towels that may be being burned now this morning. But I think both are true. I think A&M absolutely won the game, and I think Notre Dame exited that stadium last night and is existing today feeling like it absolutely gave the game away. And if Notre Dame had rallied to win at Miami 2 weeks ago, I think the same would be said, that Miami found a way to lose that game while Notre Dame found a way to win. But the difference is Miami didn't wilt. Miami stood up at the end and Notre Dame wilted.
Last thing, I don't think we can – that last play, the touchdown catch, we have not mentioned the blatant tackle by – it was either the left guard or center. Like, you get an A-gap blitz, got beat, but one leg takedown the guy. Definitely a missed holding call on that play that, you know, we're having a very different conversation if that gets called.
Yeah, Chase Basantis absolutely mauled Donovan Heinisch, and noted longtime officiating guru Terry McCauley is on the Twitter sphere, or the X sphere, I guess it is now, this morning, talking about the critical breakdown of not only missing the call, but he flat out doesn't know what the referee is looking at, and he's right in front of it. And I actually have video of the play that I'll try to share later today, because I'm right behind the referee in the end zone. So I didn't even realize at the time, until I went back and looked at it, that I've got the hold on video as well. And you wonder how that call was missed. It would have given A&M the ball with fourth and 21 from the 21. And obviously that's a different set of circumstances. But again, Notre Dame's at home twice with a double-digit lead, and inside the final 3 minutes with a touchdown lead, and it found a way to lose. And I should note, it found a way to lose with what was billed as the largest recruiting weekend ever in the modern history of Notre Dame football. They had 60, 70 dudes on campus, somewhere between 7 and 10 5-stars, depending on which ranking service or metric you look at or whatever. They had multiple legacy kids on campus. I mean, it was set up for Notre Dame to plant its flag and say, we saved our season, and instead, you know, it turned into a tent fire.
Speaking of winning or losing the game before this one that everyone had eyes on, Georgia-Tennessee. Georgia faced deficits of 7-0, 21-7, 28-27, 38-30, 41-38, and won the game anyway.
Yeah. For me, you know, that's I don't think Mike Bobo is the world's greatest offensive coordinator, but he cooks Tim Banks every single year. And that's probably the biggest frustration that I've heard from my former neighbors and friends back in East Tennessee. Vol Nation is in tatters right now, encouraged by the play of Joey Swagular, and he had a great game, did a lot of really good things against Georgia, and then Doug's the coach, so I always defer because his knowledge is so much better than mine. But Heupel got Tennessee in a position to win because he was so aggressive, and then he played for a field goal late to win it, and then they had a penalty at the worst possible time. Again, the home team with everything going its way to win, Tennessee has 10 penalties at home to Georgia's 5. It has a false start penalty as it's getting ready to line up and kick what would have been about a 37-yard field goal. Instead, it ends up being a 42- to 43-yard attempt to win it there at the end of regulation. And I bring that up because I did some research, and best I could tell, in 2024, college kickers made about 61% of their kicks that were 40 yards and beyond. So when you play for the field goal at that point in time, it's just a little bit more than a coin flip at the college level. I understand it in the NFL, but at the college level, I'm a firm believer you never stop trying to score touchdowns, especially when you're at home and especially when you got there by being aggressive and scoring touchdowns.
Georgia, for me, like they found a way to come up with big explosive plays, which we said going into the game was going to be critical in their success. When you weren't able to do it the first 2 weeks against FCS opponents, there was very little faith that they could do it against a Vols defense. But they found a way to do that, and it reminded me of some vintage Nick Saban, in that they got in some 12 personnel sets, some 2 tight end sets, pounded the ball. They had 3 guys with double digit carries, one of them being quarterback Gunnar Stockton. And then they had a third string running back that still got 5 carries for 30 yards. So they pounded the heck out of the rock. They know that's going to be their strength. And then Tennessee on the flip side got some big plays from receiver Chris Brazell, had a couple really big catches, went for almost 200 yards on 6 receptions. Tennessee had 4 receivers averaging over 11 yards a catch, which is their big play you. With their deep choice stuff. So, but the Georgia ability to run the football and get the yards needed when everyone in the stadium knew that you were going to run the ball is really what the game came down to at the end in OT.
Yeah, and Tennessee did miss. Tennessee was missing 2 starting defensive backs, 2 starting cornerbacks, including Jermon McCoy, who's not returned yet from that January ACL injury. And Georgia very smartly attacked those unproven, untested, and young guys. And I think you saw Georgia gain some offensive confidence by being smart and picking on some dudes that haven't played a lot of college ball.
To me, culture in college football is a bit like pornography. It's hard to define on a piece of paper, but you know it when you see it. And
I wouldn't know.
You know what you see when Georgia has the chance to go win a football game. You're playing a top 15 team on the road in a raucous environment. You're trailing 35-30. Gunnar Stockton fumbles the football. Here's what happens after that. Georgia defense forces a 3-and-out. Tennessee scores a touchdown right there. It's probably ball game because then you got a 2-score deficit. Josh Heupel, I thought, blinked in that moment, didn't put the ball in the air. You talk about playing for a field goal. I thought he played for a field goal right there. They went 3-and-out, force a field goal. Georgia drives the length of the field, 9 plays, 75 yards, hit the 4th-and-6 touchdown pass to London Humphreys that will live in every Tennessee fan's nightmares till the end of their days. Just an absolutely beautiful throw. Coming into this game, Georgia, Gunnar Stockton was 1 of 7, throwing the ball more than 20 yards down the field. Fourth in the game, puts it right absolutely on the money. That two-point play, they absolutely pantsed Tennessee's defense. Caught Tennessee in man coverage. Those defender, the second corner, the safety didn't banjo it at all. Found a wide open Zach Branch. Then, as we've mentioned before, played for the field goal, missed the field goal, key penalty, probably makes the field goal if not for that. And then in overtime, Joey Swaguilar throws high and wide on a first down play that certainly not would have been a touchdown, but probably would have been an 8-yard gain at minimum. That's incomplete. 1-yard run, incompletion. Tennessee kicks a field goal. We all know what's going to happen from there. You basically run the same play that Sony Michel scored on to beat Oklahoma in the Rose Bowl in the 2017 season. Every single player has changed over since then. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't believe Mike Bobo. Was Mike Bobo the offensive coordinator for that Georgia team? Anyway, no. It doesn't matter. It's a Kirby Smart football team. The players change over. The result stays the same. It's a 21-yard touchdown run, and that's basically ball game from there. That's culture. In that moment, everyone in the stadium knew. I thought Tennessee lost the game when they didn't score a touchdown after forcing that fumble. And then everyone watching the game knew that Tennessee lost the game when he missed that field goal. And when that happens, usually when that we're going to win, sideline thought hits one sideline, we're going to lose, hits the other, it's almost undefeated from there. So that's Georgia football right there to me, and that's an incredible win for Georgia and something you're going to – if you're Tennessee, it's going to struggle. It's funny to me because, to me, there's three fan bases in college football that are the most – I don't want to say beaten down, but the most weathered fan bases. Their teams have broken their hearts more in this last generation than any. That's Nebraska, Texas A&M, Tennessee. You have Texas A&M getting maybe its sweetest victory in a long, long time, hours after Tennessee gets their loss. And the results of these multi-million-dollar operations change on a dropped extra point, a missed field goal, and a referee having his eyes in the wrong direction. That's the margins that these games are decided on.
The good news for the Vols, I got three get right weeks. I got UAB, Mississippi State, and Arkansas before they take on Alabama. So you go toe to toe with Georgia. You got to think that you've got a great chance at being one of the 12 in the college football playoff. So that they'll have opportunities to prove that they've got to hope that Alabama continues to win. Oklahoma continues to win. Those are the two ranked teams. Vanderbilt, has a chance to be ranked there at the tail end of the season and heading into this week, but, limited opportunities against ranked opponents here moving forward.
Switching briefly to the big ABC night game, which of DJ Lagway's 5 interceptions was y'all's favorite?
I would say whichever interception most facilitated Brian Kelly's post-game rant was my favorite interception because shout out to my wife, Jess, for sending me that video so that we could write about it on Football Scoop because that was BK – shades of, I don't know, 7 or so years ago when a reporter from the Indy Star asked him why he couldn't win the big game, and he absolutely went off on her. And so that was vintage BK, but the people who know BK will tell you he likes this team. He's been pretty confident in this team all summer long. I don't think he expected to beat Florida by having as many first downs as Florida had points, being 10 apiece. But he did, and honestly, LSU controlled that game despite being so disjointed on offense. And DJ Lagway is looking like Cade Klubnik in terms of whose draft stock is plummeting the most. But there's another quarterback out there we'll talk about, I'm sure.
The thing I can't figure out is, like, from a coaching perspective, like, You got to be happy with finding a way to win 20-10 in a big time SEC matchup. But when you get 5 extra possessions, you've got to find a way to have more than 20 points. And that, so while I understand BK's frustration after the game, been there, you know, on the flip side, it's a totally legitimate question. You get five extra possessions and you only come away with 20 points and a 20-10 win. That's a, that's a fair question to ask at that point. So the, you know, with everything LSU was bringing back from an offensive perspective to not be as productive as I think a lot of people thought they would be at this point in the year. That's where the disappointment, the frustration is coming out from that fan base and the media surrounding LSU.
Yeah, on a night where there were six interceptions thrown, Garrett Nussmeier's pick might have been the worst of them all. But LSU's defense was coming into this game the most trusted unit, and they proved it. I mean, they absolutely dominated that game. So Billy Napier, I don't think we need to have the conversation because we're not going to say anything that we haven't already said. But some numbers from Matt Baker of The Athletic. So Billy Napier's winning percentage, .487, is the worst by any non-interim Florida coach since 1950. He would need to win his next 28 games in a row to match Dan Mullen's winning percentage, who Florida fired. Napier's 3-10 against Florida's primary rivals, including 1-3 against LSU. He's 4-15 against ranked opponents and 5-14 away from the Swamp.
Ouch. And he's got Miami coming up and then Texas and Texas A&M.
Yeah, and Miami on the road, I believe. So
correct.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how long it's going to take, but I feel like that Brent Pry, Billy Napier, and Deshaun Foster are going to be in a coffee shop together sometime pretty soon.
Yeah. I tweeted out there that there needs to be a 4-team playoff for the four most miserable teams in college football, and the winners win the right to end their season, and the losers have to keep playing. We might need to expand that to 12 by the end of the year because there's a lot of teams circling the drain right now. The good news for that Florida game is when Texas comes to town, is 1-7 might win it. So they have a chance to win that one. Last SEC game I want to talk about really is we got to mention is Vanderbilt went full babysitter on South Carolina. They got the kids bathed, put them in the pajamas, teeth brushed, and tucked them into bed early. That game in a hostile environment, they had that game wrapped up with 10 minutes still to play.
Yeah, I mean, it was 7-7, and your final score is 31-7. I mean, like, it was no fluke. Vanderbilt dominated that contest. Lenore Sellers exited injured. He's another guy that, injury or not, has not matched the hype leading into the season. And one other quick SEC game I would note would be Ole Miss outlasting Arkansas with Doug's favorite quarterback in college football running the show when Austin Simmons could not go. Doug, I know you've got some insight there, and just you shared it on our Thursday pod, but that's a neat story. Ole Miss winning 41-35. Arkansas is playing good on offense, not stopping a lot of people nearly consistently enough, and they go to Memphis next weekend before hosting the aforementioned limping leprechauns of Notre Dame.
My favorite thing from the Vandy South Carolina game is seeing the Vanderbilt joy in the side in the locker room after the game. Like, just to see a team that had been so beaten up for so long having success gives me chills to watch. Trinidad Chambliss, Ole Miss quarterback that had to step in after Austin Simmons was a game time decision, starting his first game since leading Ferris State to the national title last fall. And stepped in and did a great job. Like, he ran the ball when he needed to. He distributed it to receivers, and to see a kid that, you know, I coached with his dad at Forest Hills Northern, to see a kid that, you know, I watched grow up playing on the big stage, SEC, and answering the call. And, you know, the announcers on the game were talking about Kiffin and Charlie Weiss Jr. saw that he had something special, and everyone got to see that last night on a big stage. It was really cool to see.
If there was a weekly Heisman, I think Trinidad Chambliss absolutely wins it. And you got to give credit to Lane Kiffin for finding, I wouldn't say developing, because obviously he's had a great career before this, but creating an environment where your backup quarterback can go win you an SEC, a tight SEC game, when we've seen so many big money, high recruit guys absolutely struggling to accomplish the basics.
Yeah, I want to take a look at Trindade. It's not like they put kid gloves on him either. It was 21 of 29 for over 350 yards. He didn't step in. They didn't ask him to be a game manager. Like they hand him the offense and said, "We trust you. Let's go."
There was some discussion we had amongst the four of us late last night that Brent Pry might be let go by Virginia Tech today, as of 10:29, God's time. That has not happened, but I cannot promise that it won't happen by the time you're listening to this. So they were getting booed off the field. It was 21-0 at halftime at home to Old Dominion. Where does Virginia Tech go from here?
Well, if they were going to make a move today, you can see the logic in it, because they play Wofford next week. So you would have an interim head coach, maybe a Philip Montgomery. He's among the more veteran members of that coaching staff. You could have a veteran coach kind of take things over for what should be a get-right week against an FCS team. But it's just stunning how poorly the Brent Pry era has gone for the Hokies. And in his defense, they have very admittedly been incredibly behind the times from a financial standpoint. And again, we shared this, and we wrote about it last month or a few weeks ago with the Virginia Tech leadership saying we need to raise $200 million. And I was told point blank that they're talking about needing $200 million, and they've been at around $75 million. So that's just a huge financial deficit. Brent Pry was asked pointed questions about what he would say to fans that were booing him, that did boo them off the field, that did chant for him to be fired. And he said, "The roster's better. It's not good enough. We're not good enough to compete for championships." And, that's a problem when you're beyond year two in a program, especially in this era of college football. You don't get 4, 5, 6 years to build anymore. It just doesn't happen.
Well, competing for championships is one thing, but your roster and your budget's good enough to not be down 21 points to Old Dominion on your home field.
I think one of the bigger questions, and this is probably a whole podcast on its own, is the new landscape of college football, like the Virginia Techs, the Stanfords, where is their place? And the crown jewel right now of that conversation is Georgia Tech, the high academic, that's what you should be selling. Notre Dame's not making a great case right now, but Georgia Tech's the crown jewel, kind of the academic first institutions that, they're going to argue that you don't need a big budget. You just need the right people. And Brent Pry believes they have the right people at Virginia Tech, and they're just not as talented. Well, how do the high academic institutions compete with the blue bloods of college football if you're not going to have the big budget deal, and you've got to go to Brent Pry and the culture he's instilled there and the personality that the Georgia Tech program has? And I think that's that's the blueprint right now.
And Zach,
well, let's see there, Doug. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, JB.
I was just going to say, you're being kind to reiterate that they had a 21 point deficit. The fact is, inside of 2 minutes to go in the third quarter, Old Dominion was up 38-7. And I mean, that's just a bludgeoning. And then Brent Pry, grasping at straws, tried to say, "Well, the fourth quarter shows we're still fighting and shows we have some pieces of the puzzle." No, when a team that you're paying to come play you is using their subs and you can't, because they've whipped you so mercilessly, you can't try to call that a silver lining, especially, again, when you're far beyond your first or second year trying to rebuild that program. Whereas Stanford has so much going against it, but found a way to beat Boston College.
So let's stay there. Let's stay in the ACC. So yesterday, did we see the end of the Clemson dynasty and them slipping to become just another team? Or has that already happened a while ago and we were the national narrative around that program was just being too kind to them because of the logo on their helmets.
I think that, yeah, I mean, they made the playoffs last year, but you had some great information and on the line about that and a 57-yard field goal against SMU and some other stuff. I would contend that last year proved more of an aberration than yesterday. Last year, them winning the ACC and making the playoff in this present era. Yeah, I think Clemson is done for whatever reason. Garrett Riley, I thought, would be the $2 million offensive savior for Dabo Swinney and company. And whether it's Garrett Riley or Cade Klubnik or Dabo Swinney, we don't know, but there's too much talent for their underperforming. But I also think that's a case of Clemson lost that game, but Georgia Tech absolutely also won that game with maybe the toughest player in college football in Haynes King.
Well, I think that's a great point because in a way I see Haynes King as kind of his own worst enemy in a way, because if you're playing Georgia Tech in a one game situation, you absolutely don't want to play this team. You don't want to play go up against Haynes King. He's a linebacker playing quarterback. But can they, like, if you get in a fist fight with Georgia Tech, you're probably going to lose. But Georgia Tech has to get in 12 fist fights a year. And can they sustain this throughout an entire season without wearing themselves down by playing such a physical brand of football? Obviously, Brent Key disagrees with me. That's just a question I have. Let's do this. Find me the next time Georgia Tech's going to be an underdog. Their upcoming schedule. Temple, at Wake, Virginia Tech, at Duke, Syracuse, at NC State, at Boston College, home against Pitt, and then you get Georgia on Black Friday. So obviously they'll be an underdog to Georgia. Outside of that, when's the next time they're an underdog?
I don't know right now if you can say they would definitively be an underdog for the Bulldogs. That game is a home game. Well, actually, it's in the Mercedes Dome Stadium because if I'm remembering this correctly, and this is staggering, I was told that Georgia Tech is being paid $5 to $10 million to play that Georgia game in Mercedes Stadium rather than down the street at Bobby Dodd Stadium.
Yeah, that's correct. Incredibly small time by Georgia Tech to give up a game. You have a great chance of winning, and now you're going to be playing a home game with more of your rivals' fans in the building than you are. But Georgia Tech could be undefeated going into that game. Could very well happen.
And that would be another game. One path of two physical run first, run second football teams that will be great for the final week of college football. It would be awesome to see them both unblemished.
Absolutely. Staying in the general Appalachian region. So I think this cliche is overblown in college football that certain teams would rather go 1-11 as long as they win that one than 11-1 and lose the one. It might apply with what happened in Morgantown yesterday. Trailing by 10 points to your rival with under 10 minutes to go in year one under your new head coach, West Virginia scored the final 17 points to come back and beat Pitt in the backyard brawl for their head coach's first time in a long, long time.
I was really tuned into the post-game handshake between a fired-up Rich Rod and a very disappointed Pat Narduzzi. And right after that handshake, Narduzzi turned around and took two steps, and Rich Rod just let all of his emotions out. I wish that would have happened two steps before that, and we could have seen some fireworks between two very fiery head coaches. But Cade Bell deserves a lot of credit for Pitt's offensive transformation. They threw for over 300 yards, did a great job last year, but they just cannot find ways to win close football games down the stretch here. And you know, West Virginia, I think, had a little of the blood taste in their mouth from their loss to Ohio the week before and got right this game. So it's great to see for Rich Rod's crew.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying there, Doug. You wanted the backyard brawl to turn into an actual brawl in the post game, and that's I'm all for entertainment. K-Bell has done some nice things and put up some gaudy numbers. His offensives for Pittsburgh have tended not to do so against other power conference teams or stiffer competition. This was a really, really ugly game closing in on halftime, and the Pittsburgh offense had been really poor to that point. But, you know, what I call an ahead-of-the-curve win for Rich Rod and the Mountaineers, and it's an incredibly, incredibly damning win for the Pitt Panthers, who now, since the start of the 2023 season, guys, since the start of the 2023 season, Pitt has 16 losses. They, I believe, are now 10-16 in that stretch. Brutal run for Pitt from the halcyon days of 21-22 when they won an ACC title and won 20 or 21 games combined over a two-year span. And Zach Barnett, I don't know if you are a fan of the man who shares your initials, Zach Bryan, but I feel like that in Morgantown, they were having an old-fashioned Rich Rod revival last night.
I agree. I mess with some Zach Bryan. I like him. So in my Vibes Up, Vibes Down piece that I wrote on Monday that I guess is going to become a weekly feature now on Football Scoop because I had fun writing it and there's plenty of content. The number one team, Vibes Up team in college football is South Florida. And they had a chance to remain number one if they go on the road and beat Miami. That did not happen. Credit to Miami. This game was had a big weather delay that certainly hurt the viewership of whatever the CW network had after its Gilmore Girls rerun. But Miami did not make this game interesting. And Miami vibes are incredibly high in Miami right now. You have a chance. You're undefeated. Just beat a little brother, neighbor of South Florida that's actually in Central Florida. And now you get the Gators coming to town, and you could potentially deliver the death blow to Billy Napier.
Yeah, I didn't catch a lot of that one, but
you didn't really have a reason to. It was never really close.
Right. And I just found the viewing experience on CW Sports, and I know they are, you know, in their infancy as a sports channel at even being considered that. But the bottom graphic was very odd. I just found it really hard to watch, but Carson Beck continues to impress. Didn't play a perfect game by any stretch, but is he worth right now? Is he worth the $4 million price tag or whatever he's getting for the year? And right now that answer is emphatically yes. And if they continue to win, he's worth a lot more than that.
Yeah. And I think he's only got one pick on the year. He's completing his passes at an unbelievable clip, and he's overall making really good decisions, and he's getting the ball out so much more quickly than he did a year ago for Georgia. And, you know, remember, he's a guy that Georgia didn't necessarily say, hey, you should come back here when he got injured and decided he wasn't going into the NFL. And now he's surrounded by better skill players on the perimeter than what he had at Georgia. And he's clicking incredibly well, and I have another chance. Look, if they smoke Florida next week, and Beck is good once again, he comes out of that game as your Heisman front runner.
He's got two picks currently. He's 7 touchdowns, 2 interceptions against a South Florida defense that even Nick Saban says has some dogs on it. And when Nick Saban says your D has some dogs, it's the highest compliment I think you can receive in life.
All right, the last game on my list to discuss because we don't want to be accused of ducking this, is the preseason number one team in the country appears to not have a quarterback. I don't have an explanation for this. I used the analogy last week of the clips that made the rounds of Arch dirtying a dig route to Ryan Wingo, was that he looked like had the face of not someone who was hurt, but someone who knew that he'd shanked one off the tee. And to continue to stretch this analogy to within an inch of its life, a lot of people thought he might be Tiger Woods from day one. He's not Tiger Woods. that's fine. No one, you don't have to be a perfect quarterback from day one as a starter. But right now, you can't keep the ball in the fairway and you can't make a 2-foot putt. And I don't have an explanation for that. I don't understand how you can't complete, how you throw 11 straight incompletions against UTEP.
The only,
the calls that he's hurt are going to continue until that stops happening.
The only possible explanation that I was thinking about this a lot last night and into this morning is like there was so much hype around Texas and around Arch heading into this game that from if you're in Steve Sarkisian's shoes as a play caller, you know, combine Arch's last name with, you know, he played well in the games that he played in last year, whether it was starter or mop up duty. But there was so much hype heading into the season around him and his name and his talent that I think from a play calling perspective, you maybe think that he can handle more than he can handle. So to me, the solution here, when you throw 10 or 11 straight incompletions against UTEP, there's no explanation for, is to simplify things as much as possible. Sark gets back to some motion, pre-snap motion stuff that can tip off coverages and leverage and things like that. Which I know he's known for in his play calling career. But I just wonder if they're expecting him to do too much and need to dial it back for success. It's easy to drink the Kool-Aid early in the season and all off season when that's all you hear. But the results through three games are that he's not the guy that we thought he was. And you've got to be able to adjust to get the most out of him in the rest of your roster.
Yeah. Not the guy, certainly, that he was coast-to-coast touted to be going into the season. He's got 4 career starts at the collegiate level, and he's behind an overall mostly rebuilt Texas offensive line. He's not playing well. He's missing gimme putts, but there's still a lot of season left and plenty of opportunity contests for Arch Manning and the Longhorns. But yeah, there's real concern there. You could while away the performance at Ohio State, the defending champs, and that defense still has a bunch of NFL dudes on it. Yesterday, UTEP didn't have a bunch of NFL dudes on that defense, and Arch didn't have a great day. But somehow we're already getting ready to turn the page into week 4, and there's not necessarily the caliber of games we saw yesterday, but I'm already looking forward to week 4 because there's some nice contests, and Texas Tech, Utah might be the biggest contrast of styles that we'll see at just about any point this season. And they're both going to be ranked inside the top 20. And that's a big time game there in Salt Lake City.
So we've discussed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. We're close to a dozen games so far. What do you guys want to bring up that we haven't mentioned?
I've got the surprise score of the weekend for me was North Texas just absolutely pummeling Wazoo, and that in your backyard, Zach. And maybe you've got a beat on what's going on there. But I know who did North Texas play to, like a 3 Western Michigan, who's 0-3. They beat Western by 3 points to go to a Washington State team that has been completely revamped from coaching staff to roster to everything. And still, you know, with Oregon State searching for an identity between, you're definitely not a power team anymore, a power conference team. But they, a group of 5 team beat them like a FCS foe. So what is North Texas for real? Is Washington State just that far down that it's going to take a while to rebuild? What's the chatter down there in the Denton area, Zach?
So I think there's 2 explanations for this. One is Eric Morris kind of pulled a Kurt Cignetti and a Charles Huff, and that he not only did he hire Skylar Cassidy from Sam Houston to be his defensive coordinator, he brought a bunch of his dudes with him. And so it's not like that they had their whole defense, but a lot to where they could hit the ground running. Last year, North Texas was 111th in yards per play, 107th, sorry, 6.17. Through 3 games, they're 11th right now, 3.71, cut off nearly 3 yards per play. And Aaron Morris is as good as it gets in scoring points. So if they could just be decent defensively, they're going to be a problem for people. And early on, they're far more than decent. And then I think the second explanation is everything that we knew was going to happen to the Pac-12 orphans has happened. Oregon State and Washington State have just been absolutely decimated. I can't view the outcome in Denton in isolation from what also happened in Lubbock yesterday, and that is Oregon State lost to Texas Tech 45-14 in a game that was not as close as that score. Oregon State's lost 0-3. They've also lost to Cal and Fresno State before that. They have to play at Oregon on Saturday. God rest their souls in that one. So it's as bad for those two programs as we all feared it would be. Hopefully they can get back on their feet when the Pac-12 is remade moving forward. But, yeah, you look at what's happened. Oregon's thriving. Everyone, Stanford's absolutely decimated. UCLA decimated. Oregon State, Washington State decimated. The four corner schools seem to be doing okay. But this Pac-12 move has been absolutely terrible. The Pac-12 eruption has been absolutely as terrible as we feared it would be for a lot of those schools.
I think one of the lessons to take from here, right, is I love your term, using the term orphan. Like, there were the orphans left behind for sure. When conference realignment comes around again and you're one of those teams that looks at possibly being an orphan, you want to do everything in your power, like pull a page out of the SMU book or the other team that I know we wrote about in the last couple months that, hey, we'll forego all of our conference revenue distribution for 5 years, 10 years, whatever. Just let us in. Just let us in. We do. You don't want to be an orphan in this new age of college football.
Yeah, I mean, and you look at Virginia Tech right now and with a coaching change coming and severe budget issues exacerbating their problems. Everyone in college football thinks that there's a greater realignment coming and there will be something more of a firm line draw between the haves and have-nots. And programs like that, your Stanfords are absolutely terrified they're going to become the next Oregon State and Washington State. So that why do universities pour the issues, the resources into football that they do? That's why. Oregon State, Washington State.
I would you're exactly right. And the only thing I would disagree with, Zach, is that, yeah, people who care about Stanford athletics are terrified. There's a lot of people on that campus who don't care about Stanford athletics and don't care if they become a D3 model and don't give athletic scholarships. I did want to shout out Tulane, a very convincing, comfortable. They controlled that game against Duke to win it. That's a huge one. Tulane remains one of those G5 teams that will be a factor in the college football playoff race. Southern Miss won a single game all of last year. It has now doubled its win total with Charles Huff and the Golden Eagles dancing, if you've seen the tweet, dancing all over visiting App State yesterday. So two significant wins there for those programs. And next weekend, I believe, is Indiana, Illinois, and that's a big time game as well. That may be the game I'm most looking forward to next weekend.
One school I want to shout out that we haven't really mentioned on the podcast, but an outcome that's more impressive than meets the eye to me is Missouri 52, Louisiana 10. Is Louisiana going to win the Sun Belt, make the playoff? Probably not, but that's a solid Sun Belt program. And Missouri ran for 427 yards and 5 touchdowns in that game. Curtis Looper, a football scoop running back coach of the year, award winner, told me preseason that Ahmad Hardy, kid that they got from ULM, might be the best running back he's ever coached. He went for 250 and 3 touchdowns on 11.4 per carry last week. So Missouri, I think, is a better team than a lot of people probably assume. And I think there's a question to be made. You mentioned the Duke-Tulane game. Did Tulane upgrade in losing Darian Mensah for Jake Ratzlaff? It's a question that must be asked. And then did Penn State pick the wrong quarterback in giving Bo Prabula his walking papers to hold on to Drew Aller? I don't know what they did, but that's, it's a question that must be asked.
As a Big Ten fan, I would like to propose that the Big Ten trades UCLA for Cal straight up at this point in the year, for Coach Ack to come on and say we're going to see better teams than UCLA, and I know UCLA is a Power Five program, but we're going to see better teams on our schedule than UCLA. Is the biggest slap in the face to Deshaun Foster and that Bruins program, but it's a slap in the face they deserved after getting routed by the Lobos. So I would like to propose that trade to be effective immediately.
That was only the second biggest slap that Ek delivered, Doug, as you're correct. The biggest slap was what they did on the field, and it was an evisceration. It was a dog walking. I mean, they won that contest absolutely going away and laughing and having a great time in the process and picking up a hell of a paycheck.
Exactly.
I can't believe we're 50 minutes into this podcast and it took that long to get to that game, but that's how much happened in college football on Saturday and Friday as well. So that's it for us. We'll be back Tuesday with our starting quarterback, Scott Rousseau, back behind center. Thanks for everyone for listening. Like, subscribe, tell your friends, tell your dog. Bye.